tasting and an extensive Saturday tasting party with over 50 items. Information at 309-663-2222 or at worldgourmetfoods.com, bringing the taste of the world to Bloomington Normal.
Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you're listening. During this hour of Focus 580, our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic here in Champaign. She specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of disorders of the stomach, liver, gallbladder, and digestive tract. And that's what we're talking about during this hour. We welcome your questions. That's what this show is all about, trying to give you some good advice on health issues, in this case, gastroenterology. And, of course, we can't do diagnosis and treatment over the telephone and the radio, but we can certainly try to help you out with some good advice, information, and etc. So if you have questions for us, you are welcome to give us a call. Our phone number around Champaign-Urbana, that is within the 217 area code, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line outside the 217 area code if you're listening outside. Use our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is an alum of the University of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana, and where she got her medical degree and did her fellowship at Indiana University, and is board certified in gastroenterology. And we're glad to have her with us. Dr. Nugent, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, where do we even begin when we start talking about these issues? There are all kinds of things that that can go wrong in terms of, you know, gastroenterology. How do you go about when someone comes in with, GI tract issues? How do you begin figuring out what's going on?
Well, most people will have pretty specific complaints related either to upper or lower GI tract. And we certainly have a range of tests everywhere from labs to endoscopies. But we find in papers that published that show really taking a history from a patient and just talking with people is the most important part of the entire workup because it leads you to the right spot.
Are there particular issues that occur, you know, based on the patient's age as we get older that we experience more particular kind of thing?
Yeah, I think as people get older, things start to get a little bit weaker, and that includes many sphincters.
Mm-hmm.
So I think reflux becomes more of a common problem. As we get older, most people tend to gain weight as well, and it puts more stress on older functioning organs. Constipation is more of an issue, bowel continence, all of the above, and all those are related to sphincter control and sphincter strength, which becomes a problem again as we get older.
And we may talk more about diet too, because I'm rather curious about this, and perhaps people have questions about diet as well and its effect on our long-term GI health. Are there particular things that we really should be, you know, thinking about as human beings on this planet in terms of, you know, the way that, you know, that we manage our diet and how that affects our GI tract?
Most definitely. There are a lot of issues from simply abuse of our bodies as we were younger and didn't feel we had to follow a special diet, fiber being probably a primary thing that we see, which eventually as you get older, your body starts to pay back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time to pay the piper, so to speak. Lack of fiber earlier in life can lead to problems such as diverticulosis, which can be a problem and is seen in almost all patients in the United States over the age of 50. It doesn't necessarily cause problems in all those patients, but you see it a lot more. Certainly, there are also articles that suggest that lack of fiber may increase the risk of colon cancer, which, of course, is also quite high in the United States.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them. That's what this show is all about, and welcome others as well. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Listener in Paxton on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick episode to relate to the doctor. Maybe she can, look into it. I've got a daughter, 10-year-old daughter, she's quite active, very happy, no problem. When she was 7, she had a unique problem. It was called a pyloric spasm. We didn't realize it at the time, but she had episodes almost every night for quite a while where she would vomit, but only bile. And this is only after she ate a meal, she wouldn't throw up any food, but it would be just gut-wrenching, literally. And after a number of doctors and MRIs, we finally took her to the Children's Hospital in St. Louis, and this was diagnosed as a pyloric spasm. It's a simple muscle relaxant that she took every night, and the problem went away. The doctor told us she would probably grow out of it. And everything's been fine. She's 10 now, still very active, very happy. Problem seems to be recurring, not so much so severe, but she does seem to have these periodic stomach problems. And I didn't realize you can't give a diagnosis over the phone, but I'm just wondering, my wife and I, you know, if it's a premenstrual type situation or would this pyloric spasm be reoccurring? She hasn't been taking the muscle relaxants for over 2 years now. And I just was wondering, number one, how common this was, and number two, I guess what your expertise would be on this.
Well, this is a wide open area and probably delves with a lot of irritable bowel syndrome aspects, which is really functioning of the GI tract. And when you throw off the functioning, no matter what the cause, it can cause amazing symptoms. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's difficult to diagnose because there's so much variability within what's normal for movement of the GI tract that there's not a real good way of measuring most of the movements. Pyloric spasm is probably not something that can be measured, but you make sure that nothing else is going on, and the antispasm medicines simply block that aspect. I'm not a pediatric gastroenterologist, but I know from seeing especially women, young women, as they're going through the hormonal changes, and even mature women that are going through the men's, periods and birth control pills and any type of hormonal manipulation or changes, pregnancy, et cetera, there's a big impact on the GI tract, many of which have not been studied, and there's probably hormones and chemicals that we haven't even identified that have big impact on the system.
Is there a possibility, I understand, you know, over the phone here, but is there a possibility that this particular problem could be resurfacing?
Yeah. In fact, most people, I think, when you start to deal with functioning disorders of the GI tract, tend to have it off and on throughout their lifetime. And again, there are big times of major stress can induce it because there are all kinds of chemicals that are released with stress. And then certainly hormonal changing times can also induce it. So,
all right. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, doctor. I appreciate it.
Certainly.
Okay. Good luck. We have a caller also on line number two next in Savoy, I believe. Good morning.
Hello. I'm referring to the previous caller. Our daughter, too, had serious GI problems, and they put her on Propulsid and other things, and it really caused enormous problems. And then later on, we took her to a physical therapist, and they found out most of these problems were caused by the psoas muscle. And by doing physical therapy, most of the problems went away. And if we had done that originally, we wouldn't have had to use these horrible drugs that caused years worth of problems afterwards.
Yeah, it can be very difficult to tell sometimes whether abdominal pain is actually coming from skeletal muscles, which are our conscious control muscles, much like muscles in our arms. And the psoas muscle actually lies in towards our back, but within the back of the abdomen. And that can be very difficult to actually diagnose what's going on in a situation like that. Perfect example is people that get problems with pain moving their legs when they have an acute appendicitis, because the appendix lies also towards the back, sometimes can inflame that muscle, and then you're looking for a muscular problem rather than the appendix. Mm. So I can imagine it must have been a very difficult time for you.
It was. I just wanted to counsel the gentleman before to possibly look at a physical therapist before doing anything else. At least, you know, you can poke around and see if there's a problem there without having to get into a lot of chemicals that can cause other problems.
Okay.
That's all I had.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
We have another call waiting, and plenty of time for others. Our other lines are open if you want to join us. Our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic here in Champaign. And questions along those lines are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We have an Indiana caller next on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Ruth. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on?
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. I was at a spa and got a lecture from a gentleman who was talking about, body fat. And he was saying that that the fat cells themselves block absorption through the intestine. And, he was proposing and trying to sell his detox. And how legitimate is detox to the GI tract and fat metabolism and all that?
Well, fat, unfortunately, does not block things from being absorbed. Otherwise, obese people would not have a problem losing weight, I think. And it also depends on where the fat is. Now, you can have fat malabsorption, but it has nothing to do with the fat that actually is within the GI tract. I may be missing exactly what you're asking, but I know there are a lot of people that do colon cleansing,
right?
Which I personally am not a proponent of. I think it can be unhealthy if it's done incorrectly, and I guess it's not mainline medicine. Admittedly, there's probably a lot of things out there that are not mainline medicine that are not bad for you, may be good for you. But I think a lot of times colon cleansing is taken to an extreme where you actually are causing more problems with electrolyte balance and imbalance, et cetera, than doing any good.
Mm-hmm. What he was basically saying, and particularly pointing to abdominal fat, saying that the pressure that abdominal fat, and specifically the hard abdominal fat, had on the GI tract was causing just malabsorption, and that people who have a body high betas like that were toxic, basically, and needed to do detox, which involves colon cleansing and also eating pretty much a vegan diet and stuff like that.
Well, it brings up an interesting point that fat can store certain chemicals and certain toxins. Unfortunately, doing a colon cleansing won't leach that out of your fat. Particularly not the abdominal fat, even though it's closer maybe to the colon than fat in your neck. But there's no studies at all that show that that's at all helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. That kind of clears up my suspicions about his cell.
Okay.
Glad to be of help.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks so much for the call. We had a question off the air. Somebody emailed in before the show asking about Crohn's disease. And I didn't know anything about it, at least not by that name. But the question was, anything going on, recently about research into the treatment of Crohn's disease? Maybe you could, if you could describe what it is, and then we can go from there.
Sure. Crohn's disease is actually an inflammatory problem that involves any part of the GI tract, but most commonly the small intestine and the colon. It actually involves the entire wall of the intestine and can cause fistulas and tunnels between different areas. It can be more superficial and just cause ulcerations within the GI tract. It is not a terribly uncommon problem, unfortunately. I mean, it is a prime area of interest in as far as autoimmune disease study, because it's becoming actually more common, and we're not really sure why. Mm. We don't know what sets it off. There may be a genetic predominance or predisposition, I should say, to getting it, but the theory is that something that we're exposed to in our life sets it off. It's most commonly becomes a problem in early adulthood or adolescence. There's another peak around the age of 50 to 60, again, for new problems, but we're not really sure why. Probably the major area of research right now is into anti-tumor necrosis factor agents, which are blocking part of the inflammatory cascade in a way that none of the previous medicines that we've used has. Mm. Those medicines include things like Remicade or Infliximab, Humira, and then there's going to be a host of other ones that probably come out. And those are the newest things that we're seeing, although they've been available now for probably about 5 or 6 years at least.
Okay. Well, we have another caller to talk with, someone on a cell phone. Line number one, good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This question is sort of from left field. Is there any known correlation or causative connection between type 2 diabetes and GERD, and is the treatment of one cause any problems with the treatment of the other, or do they both actually work, you know, sort of in sync? And I'll hang up with this. Thank you.
As far as risk factors for both of them, probably the biggest risk factor for diabetes mellitus, diabetes type 2, adult onset is another name for that, is obesity. And also there's certainly some familial factors that play into that, but obesity is probably a major part of that, which would also then increase potentially your reflux potential. So as far as that goes, those things would hang together. Other than that, probably not. It's certainly diabetes, if it becomes severe as far as other potential problems, it can affect the way the stomach empties. And if the stomach is not emptying correctly and things back up, certainly that will also increase your potential for having reflux. The medicines that to treat reflux disease and the medicines to treat diabetes don't really affect the other. The only caveat I would say is if the blood sugars are being better controlled, your stomach empties more. Empties better. All the contraction, everything works better when your blood sugar is where they're supposed to be. So if your blood sugars are way off, you can actually have slow gastric emptying, which again would predispose to more reflux problems. But other than that, there's probably not a whole lot of correlation.
Hope that gives the caller's question. We're talking this morning with Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic here in Champaign. Your questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. One thing that you mentioned as a factor that exacerbates problems is something that seems to exacerbate everything, and that's stress.
Yeah.
You know, how big a factor is that in terms of, you know, GI problems? It's probably a kind of a goofy question because it's obviously a huge factor in all kinds of health issues.
Well, it definitely is, and stress certainly probably can create some situations that make them worse.
Mm-hmm.
But stress makes you less tolerant of what you already have, I think, is a big component of that.
Mm-hmm.
You always hear patients that will come in and they'll have different symptoms, and there'll be chronic problems that you're trying to deal with, and they go on vacation and they are just feeling great, no problems. Come back and they're right back where they started. But life is stress, so
yeah.
You have to deal with it. Certainly, stress also causes certain chemical release within the body as well, and that definitely has an effect on the GI tract. And some people are going to be more sensitive, some people less. Some people develop chronic headache problems, neck pain, back pain from being stressed out. Other people develop stomach problems from it.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone is a little bit different with how they react.
Well, maybe we can follow up on that because I have some other questions. But we have a caller waiting, so let's defer to them. Someone in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
I'm calling because I have irritable bowel syndrome and have been working really hard to try to get it under control, and medicine hasn't worked, and I'm trying diet again. I'm working on stress and exercise. My biggest problem right now is odor. Is there anything you can recommend?
Odor of what specifically?
Just foul smelling, no matter how clean I try to get.
Of the anal area?
Yeah.
Then? Okay. That has probably less to do with the irritable bowel syndrome than it does just with trying to clean the area. Now, the anal area has got a lot of wrinkles, and stool can collect on those folds, and that can be quite difficult to clean out. Some people will wash themselves afterwards after they have bowel movements. The wet wipes can be used. Again, those are gentle ways of cleaning, and that can be very helpful with odor.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Irritable bowel syndrome is something that a lot of people seem to have, you know, difficulties with, and someone was asking me before the show, I'm not sure what to ask about it because it seems like, you know, is it a sort of a complex of problems? Is it one description for a different whole range of issues? What is IBS?
Well, actually, I noticed your book there. It's yeah. making sense of irritable bowel syndrome. I'm not sure that you can make sense of irritable bowel syndrome because it is a complex problems, and it is a complex of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, most definitely. We tend to group patients into a group of irritable bowel syndrome when there's no other reason for their problems, and it seems to be more of a functioning of the GI tract. Now, is it a functioning of the small intestine? Is it a functioning of the large intestine? That would be subgroups within that problem. There are even a subgroup of people that have non-ulcer dyspepsia, which is probably an irritable bowel version of the upper GI tract. So that's yet another entity, and it's kind of grouped together. It can be very difficult to distinguish between them. Is it actually a problem with the way things are functioning, or is it a hypersensitivity to normal functioning? There's subgroups there as well, and it just becomes more and more complex. So it's very difficult sometimes to delineate, but I think it's very important when you're trying to treat patients to make as much difference as you can between the little subgroups, because I think you can aim your therapy a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm. Does it have to do with diet in many cases?
There are certainly some aspects of diet, and there are probably some intolerances and maybe some either malabsorption problems
yeah.
that tend to get grouped into irritable bowel syndrome, which aren't actually irritable bowel. And I think one disease that we're becoming more and more aware of, all the medical societies are trying to push for us to become more aware of this because it has not been diagnosed probably as often as it should be, and that is celiac disease. Which is actually a gluten intolerance, which is a major protein found mostly in wheat and then in some other grains as well. And a lot of patients that have had irritable bowel syndrome actually had celiac disease with mild problems with it and have just been misdiagnosed there. Certainly there are some food intolerances with irritable bowel syndrome. Those can be very personal for each patient. I let the patient tell me which foods they just don't tolerate and which they do. Often I find, however, that true irritable bowel syndrome patients tolerate everything from time to time, but when their irritable bowel syndrome is more of a problem, then they don't tolerate things that they may have tolerated the day before.
Interesting. You mentioned gluten intolerance, and that's another issue that I was going to ask about if we had time. Is it actually an allergic reaction? What's going on with that?
Celiac disease is truly an allergic response
yeah.
to gluten.
Okay.
And it causes an inflammatory effect in the small intestine, which thereby leads on to different problems. It's a strange disease. It used to be thought it was most common in Ireland, but we're finding that it's actually very common throughout Western Europe. Anything above the Sahara practically, it can be diagnosed, and certainly very much in the United States because of our heritage
mm-hmm.
as well. For many people anyway. It can be so variable within even a lifetime in one patient that it can be quite difficult to diagnose. And we've gone from underdiagnosing it. We're probably going to overdiagnose it because there are some patients that will be positive for all the testing factors. They may even have a positive biopsy on their small intestine but will never have any symptoms from it within their lifetime. And then there are other people that can have terrible symptoms and almost die from it at one stage of life and then be at another many years later and have absolutely no problems at all and have forgotten the diagnosis and eat anything they want. So it's a very odd disease.
Wow. Well, I have a friend who is, gluten intolerant, and she's really upset about it because she likes beer, and unfortunately
can't. There's wheat beer.
Well, that's right. There is.
And then, actually, there are rice beers, actually.
That's right.
The rice beers, not the wheat beers.
Gluten-free beer.
Right.
That's true. But it's not quite the same, she says.
No, I suppose not.
No. We're at our midpoint with Dr. Claudia Nugent, gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. Our lines are open if you would like to join us with your questions. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Speaking of beer, alcohol, I guess in general, can we say about the effect of alcohol? And perhaps it's a question of moderation, but, it's always a question of moderation, I suppose. But
is
alcohol problematic in particular?
To a certain extent, certainly. Moderation is always the key.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with the cardiac benefits of a small amount of alcohol, I don't want to say people should not have any alcohol at all, but again, moderation is truly the key. Certainly alcohol, especially in large quantities, can be very hard on the stomach. Mm-hmm. It can certainly also be hard on the esophagus itself. It's not quite an acid, but again, it's just very hard on the lining itself. And then certainly alcohol in large quantities is difficult for the liver to metabolize and can also cause pancreatic problems. So there's a lot of host of problems that can be created by too much alcohol.
There seemed to be some research indicating that red wine in particular was, to some extent, again, in moderation, beneficial to the GI tract. Is that myth? What would you say about that?
It's probably not so much the GI tract as to the cardiovascular system,
okay.
To the heart.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, we have several callers, and let's go next to another Champaign listener, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I've got a question. I need to take an iron supplement because my iron level is extremely low. And when I take it, I get extremely painful constipation. So, of course, I was told to take Metamucil. And I've been using the Metamucil capsules. But when I do that, it just seems like my intestines are just constantly sort of irritated. And so I'm wondering if you have any suggestions.
Certainly iron is very commonly constipating. Metamucil is a psyllium fiber. It's a good fiber, but it also tends to create a lot of gas. And so that can be a problem. Some people just don't tolerate that. You might look for just a different type of fiber that you're going to tolerate. There's another brand name out there called Benefiber that has, I believe, is the Guam fiber. And there's also another Metamucil product called FiberSure that's using a different type of fiber that you might tolerate. Those are probably two examples. I've had some patients that use flaxseed. They tolerate that better. It's a matter of getting in the fiber that you need to keep things moving, and water being also very important for the situation, but something that you tolerate. So it may be some trial and error to get to a fiber that you tolerate better.
So you're thinking it's the psyllium, and I should look for something without psyllium.
Right. Citracell is also psyllium-based. I think those are the two main ones that are psyllium-based.
Okay, well, thank you.
Certainly. Great.
Next up, another Champaign listener, line number two. Good morning.
Yeah, what's the, in terms of polyps, I don't know whether I just tuned in, I don't know if you've covered that or not.
No, we have not.
Okay. Gee, you're great.
No problem.
In terms of the colon, I've had them, in the past they were discovered, and then I've gone back, again and again and have not had problems, and certainly in terms of diet, it's gotten better in terms of fiber. Is it hereditary, or is it just, or is there any new evidence on it or anything in terms of polyps? What causes them, whatever?
Right. To a certain component, to a certain extent, yes, polyps have a genetic basis for occurring. And so people that have a family history of colon polyps or colon cancer, especially in anyone under the age of 60 or under, then we know there seems to be some type of a genetic predisposition to getting polyps. That's not 100%, obviously. And again, there's something in the environment and something that we eat that seems to bring that on, something in our defenses that somehow blocks our own body doing surveillance for abnormal cells, whether that be smoking, for example, or something else that affects the immune system. There are certain strange or situations, I should say more rare situation, where there's a very strong hereditary component, where there's a single gene that's been identified, and those patients sometimes have to actually have their colon removed because their potential for getting colon cancer is so high within their lifetime. We don't see that as often, but that definitely has a genetic basis. But most people, again, because you've developed polyps that are potentially precancerous, thereby, by definition, your body has got that genetic makeup, and therefore you have a potential for creating more in the future and should have continued screening.
Yeah. It takes a long time. In other words, usually what they do is if you had the polyps and they're removed, and then a year later you go back, and then if not, then usually what come back in 2 or 3 years. In terms of growth, they actually grow somewhat slowly, don't they?
Yes, for most people, that's quite true, which is why the current screening recommendations are for patients that have had their routine screening colonoscopy and there are no other risk factors, that, and at age 50, they have no colon polyps, then they can actually wait 10 years.
Wow.
That's what current recommendations are. And current recommendations, even for patients that have small polyps under the side of 1 centimeter that have less than 3, you can wait 5 years for the next colonoscopy. Those are the routine recommendations for what we usually run into. There are certain situations, obviously, that are you have to change those recommendations a little bit. How well was the colon actually prepped? How clean were things when you were looking? All those are factors that you have to consider when you make your recommendations for more exams.
Spikes certainly are not a problem when it comes to, you know, that certainly wouldn't be a factor. What about for irritated bowel syndrome? Spikes is good, bad, or depends?
Individual for the patient. I have some patients that absolutely do not tolerate real spicy foods and hot peppers, for example, that makes them have diarrhea. And I have other patients that say the hotter the better. They have absolutely no problem with it. So.
But in terms of the irritated bowel syndrome, that isn't particularly the reason or the thing. I mean, some people can tolerate it, some can't. Is that what it comes down to even with that?
Exactly.
Okay. I know it has, again, to do with fiber. As long as you keep things moving along, it certainly is much better.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Certainly.
Thanks so much for the call. A couple callers waiting. I want to just ask a quick follow-up in terms of colonoscopies and recommendations. Is there a particular, you know, someone doesn't have a family history of polyps or colon cancer, is there a particular recommendation in terms of when they ought to be regularly examined?
The current recommendations are that around age 50, you need to have some type of colon evaluation. And most people, I think, are moving towards simply having a full colonoscopy at age 50 with no other risk factors involved. There are other ways of screening the colon that are still certainly acceptable. Mm-hmm. They're being done less often, but they're acceptable, and that is to do stool card evaluations for microcytic blood, microscopic blood. Those are stool tests that are done. If those are negative, you can have a sigmoidoscopy every 3 to 5 years and continue to do those stool tests on a yearly basis. As long as those continue to be negative, you can continue to do that. There are some studies that suggested we're seeing more right-sided colon polyps, however, than left-sided, which has been a little bit concerning. But as long as you continue close follow-up, that's still an acceptable guideline for screening. Alternatively, doing a sigmoidoscopy with a barium enema, as long as stool card testing is negative, can be done every 5 years. That's also acceptable. But I think most people are preferring to do a full colonoscopy because you're actually seeing in very good detail ways of looking at the right colon as well as the left colon.
Okay. Very good. A couple callers waiting, and we'll go next to a listener in Fithian, line number 3. Good morning.
Hello. On Monday, I'm going to have a hydroscope to check my gallbladder with Kinevac, and I was wondering if you could explain what that is and does. And
sure.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
It's a HIDA scan. It's a nuclear medicine scan done by radiology, and they inject a certain type of dye into your bloodstream that's taken up by the liver. The liver then handles it much like it would bile. It spits it out into the bile duct system. It's taken up by your gallbladder. The gallbladder then squeezes. The Kinevac will increase the squeeze, and they will measure how strong your gallbladder squeeze is to see it actually travel then into the small intestine.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. If not, feel free to call back and follow up. We have one caller waiting and plenty of time for others. The remaining lines are open, 333-9455. That's around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Caller in Champaign next, line number 1. Good morning.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. This concerns a sister of mine. She's 77, lives out of state. And she called me and told me that she had lots of reflux, stomach, how is it called?
Reflux?
Yeah, reflux. And went to a doctor, and she had an upper and lower GI, which showed that she has a little bit of a ulcer in her duodenum. And then also they found a bit of feces in the small intestines. And it was recommended that she does a full colonoscopy, which she's afraid of. And she doesn't know what it means that she has a little bit of feces left in the small intestines. Doesn't one have feces in the small intestines normally?
Yes, it's not actually called feces or stool in the small intestine, but it certainly is contents. I suspect what they actually said was that she had some feces left in the large intestine, and since they couldn't see the lining of the large intestine in that area very well, they suggested she have a colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm. I see.
That would make more sense.
Yeah. She told me, she told me that they said the small intestines, and that's why she, she had some first aid training. She used to go out with the ambulances and all that. So she has a little bit of training. Mm-hmm. And therefore, she said she was perplexed about it, that they told her that feces is left in the small intestines and it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, I would be perplexed about that too. I think probably they said large intestine or they misspoke.
Okay. That would be normal to have feces in the small intestines.
No, it would be normal to have it in the large intestine.
Oh, it's not normal to have in the small intestines?
Well, it's not usually solid in the small intestine.
Uh-huh.
So when we evaluate the small intestine, first of all, you don't see it very well doing a lower GI x-ray, mm-hmm, because it doesn't go up that high.
Uh-huh.
And unless they extended the upper GI.
She had both, upper and lower.
Right, but there's a... Often you don't even look at the small intestine because problems in the small intestine are very rare.
Uh-huh. I see. So that is why the colonoscopy would be helpful.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. A couple other callers waiting. Someone in Charleston next, line number 2. Good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like some information about seeds in the case of diverticulosis, particularly seeds that you'd find in jam, like raspberry jam and other fruits and vegetables, and if they would cause the problems that create diverticulitis.
That's actually a very good question. There's always been a sense that small seeds would be a problem, for example, raspberry seeds or strawberry seeds, tomato seeds, by getting caught in these small openings in the large intestine and then blocking drainage from the opening, these pockets, and then thereby causing a secondary diverticulitis. That's really never been shown, though. And most cases of diverticulitis are actually caused by hard stool that gets actually clogged in the opening, and that causes the diverticulitis problem rather than any seeds. So I think many patients, however, will swear that if they eat popcorn, nuts, that causes them abdominal pain. And I think that most of those cases, it's actually an intolerance to those foods because it's actually causing intestinal movement and spasming in the colon. The left side of the colon where most of the diverticulosis lies is often an oversensitive area. And when you get contractions, they become very vigorous and you get pain, but you're not actually having a diverticulitis attack where there's actually infection. So many seeds are actually helpful because they're fiber. And in my practice, I do not tell people to avoid those seeds unless they just don't tolerate them. And that, again, is quite individual. But I think for the most part, it does not actually cause diverticulitis attacks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Another caller in Champaign next, line number 3. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't have a question so much as a possible suggestion. A few years ago, I had my, as my physician said, 55,000-mile checkup, and part of the preparation was to consume something called New Lightly Prep, which causes galloping diarrhea. The stuff doesn't taste good, and I was told that, so what I did was mix it up in the jug that it came in and chilled it down in the refrigerator. And then I used a heavy glass mug to drink it, which I kept in the freezer, and got it as cold as possible. And that helped quite a bit
get
it down.
Yeah. Did you drop your body temperature by a few degrees when you were doing it?
I do not know. It sure made it more palatable.
Yeah.
The mug was cold enough so that the prep would tend to freeze on the inside of it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But it thawed by the time I got each dose down, but it was right at freezing temperature, which helped a lot.
Yeah, none of those preps taste very good. And especially the preps like the New Lightly, there's a large quantity that you're trying to drink, and the colder they are, I think the less taste they have. The problems that I personally have seen, especially with the larger volume preps, is that people actually get so chilled when they're drinking them because they're so cold that they have a problem staying warm enough to drink them. But I agree, the colder they are, the better.
Well, that wasn't the problem with me. I like cold drinks. All right, that's all I had. Thank
okay.
You.
Well, thanks for that. Our lines are open. We have just about 10 minutes left with Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic here in Champaign, taking your questions on GI issues. Your phone calls are welcome at 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask about ulcers and viruses. There seemed to be some research in recent years, and I don't know if there's anything more recent about that, the connection between ulcers and viruses, that there seemed to be a sort of a dawning that they're very closely connected in many cases and perhaps most.
Yeah, there is actually a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a very close association, and actually the two people that originally described that got the Nobel Prize for medicine this year, which was kind of interesting, they actually ingested and drank the bacteria to show that they could cause the same gastritis that is often associated with inflammatory effects in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
They never actually caused an ulcer, but studies since then have actually shown that if the Helicobacter is present when there's an ulcer around, and whether it actually causes that or not, I think can still be argued. But certainly if the Helicobacter is present, then the potential for having more ulcers down the road is much, much higher. If you can get rid of the Helicobacter, the risk for ulcer disease goes down significantly. We routinely now, if there are stomach ulcers and duodenal ulcers found, routinely do biopsies to look for the bacteria, and there are other ways of looking for it as well, and then treat accordingly. And we've certainly decreased the incidence of ulcers caused by that bacteria. The interesting thing is there is a subgroup of patients that have ulcer problems that are not related to the bacterial infection, and we're actually seeing a rise in those types of ulcers as opposed to the bacterial-induced ulcers.
Okay. Well, our lines are suddenly filled up, so let's go on and take as many calls as we can. Next up, someone in Vermilion County, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. And this is a follow-up to the New Lightly call that preceded this. About a couple of years ago, I had about 6 or 8 times, I can't remember, that I had to be put to sleep and cleaned out. And so the first few times I had New Lightly, but I got so that anticipating it was such that my whole digestive system would just rebel. And I'm wondering, you know, are there some lower volume ones that work effectively that you could just, at one point in a hospital, I was given something from a brown bottle that was only about 8 ounces of liquid. I'm wondering what those are and, you know, what I could ask for if it ever came up again.
I hope that came up as a pun. I suspect that's the type of reaction that you had.
Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, there are different preps. The original preps were a full gallon jug of things, and those are very difficult to get down. And I can imagine once you've had those at least even once, sometimes anticipating it the next time is pretty difficult. The brown bottle that you had sounds to be magnesium citrate, which can be used, and sometimes we use that, especially in patients that have significant kidney problems, because you can't use phosphate-based laxatives, and magnesium citrate is safer to use in that situation. It's not as strong. You have to use more of it, and so we don't use it as often. There is now a Fleet's phosphosoda prep that's routinely being used, which is 1.5 to 2 ounces of the laxative mixed in of clear liquid of your choice, and usually 2 doses of that spread apart by 6 to 7 hours is just as good, and studies have shown it's just as good at cleaning the colon out. So that's a definitely less volume thing. There's also a pill prep using Visicol tablets that's now available, but you have to take about somewhere between 30 and 40 tablets for the prep. So if people are not good pill swallowers, that's less of an option. But you can individualize, certainly, the prep to make it a little bit easier for patients.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. My parents, and I missed this earlier, you may have talked about this, but both of my parents had colon cancer, along with various other types of cancer. And I'm still told 50 is an okay age for a colonoscopy. I mean, do you agree with that?
It depends on the age that your parents were diagnosed. It also depends on what other cancers were present, because there are some hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer syndromes. Now, the name for those was Lynch syndrome, type 1 and 2, where colon cancers don't necessarily arise as a polyp first.
Uh-huh.
And then, so it's that is an association with other hereditary cancers. So
okay.
It really depends on the situation and the age.
Okay. Well, like my mom, she had like breast cancer, lung cancer, liver cancer, kidney cancer, colon cancer. And she had all those. She had colon in between that. My dad started out with colon cancer, and then his progressed into liver cancer.
How old was your father?
My dad was 62. Yeah, I think he would have been about 62, 63.
Okay.
And my mom was 50 when she had breast cancer, but she was about 55, I think, when she had colon cancer.
Was the colon cancer spread from the breast cancer? Or
no,
she
had breast, and then she had lung, and then she had colon. And they said at the time that the colon didn't come from the breast cancer.
Okay. It would be unusual, but not impossible. I've certainly seen
situations. They said it didn't.
Okay.
Come from that.
Okay. As far as your father's history, that's going to be the easiest to address probably. Again, if colon cancer is diagnosed in someone in their 60s, then you should start screening. The rule of thumb is in your 40s or 10 to 15 years prior to the youngest relative that was diagnosed with the cancer.
Okay.
So already, you know, in your 40s would probably be the recommendation for you. Now, as far as your mother's situation, first of all, breast cancer, there was some suggestion in early studies that breast cancer might increase the risk of colon cancer and that those coincide a lot. I think that has been put to rest, that breast cancer is not an increased risk for colon cancer, although that question is, I think, still is out there to a certain extent, and some people still use that. But I think overall that's kind of been put to rest. Lung cancer, we do not believe to be related either or have any correlation. There is there's a lot of other family history that we need be obtained, but there mm-hmm. is a hereditary non-polyp-forming colon cancer syndrome associated with kidney cancers and ureteral cancers, also associated with uterine cancers. That is a totally different genetic issue.
Okay. Now, What are some signs that you what are things that you should look for that you should be concerned with? I mean, I haven't had anything like my parents had.
Right.
And I had a sigmoidoscopy I don't know, how old am I? About 5 years ago.
Okay.
4 or 5 years ago. And that was fine.
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 43.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are no signs of colon cancers often until it's late.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is why we can't do any screening. But certainly rectal bleeding, if there's a low-lying cancer or a large polyp, that can be a sign. Although, quite honestly, rectal bleeding is usually from other things.
Okay.
But that certainly is something. Sometimes people will actually get diarrhea problems from some larger colon polyps and colon cancers. Certainly, if people are anemic, that's a concern.
Okay. All right. Well, I just wanted to check. And like I said, I hope I didn't know if you covered it and I just missed it. But thanks a lot.
Certainly.
Okay. Thanks
Bye.
For the call. We have one call remaining and just a couple minutes left. Someone in St. Charles, line number two. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus and I heard that I was at a higher risk for cancer. Do you know what percent? I've heard figures all around from 20% to less than 1%. Do you have any numbers? I'm 66 years old.
Yeah, the number is probably less than 1%.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, Barrett's esophagus, we believe to be a potentially precancerous situation where the lining of the esophagus changes to predispose to possible cancerous progression. And there's certain screening parameters that are set out. The screening, however, has really decreased in how frequently, because the number of patients that actually do progress to esophageal cancer is so low, even with Barrett's. No, it's still higher than the general population. It's still extremely low.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Okay, bye. Thanks very much for the call. Well, we're just about out of time, and just as a sort of way of wrapping up, we sort of mentioned a couple of times the issue of stress and that there are issues that people have that may be asymptomatic, I think, that may from time to time become apparent. And I guess I'm just curious as to your feeling about to what extent one ought to just be somewhat proactive in sort of, you know, getting screened at various points in their life in various ways to, you know, see if there are asymptomatic issues that, you know, that don't occur until those moments when, you know, they do flare up.
Well, certainly. Colon cancer is very easy. Yeah. That screening needs to be done. We have made a definite impact on the amount of colon cancer in the United States because we have a precancerous lesion we can remove and be done with, and that's done all through screening processes. Upper GI problems and upper GI cancers are less common here. There are not any routine screening parameters that are really delineated, simply because the yield is so low. But usual rule of thumb is if you're having heartburn, stomach aches, things that are not getting better with the normal treatment, then things just need to be evaluated further. And they're easy exams to do. Upper GI especially is a whole lot easier than the colonoscopy. There's no prep involved. It's a very easy exam. It's fast. It's painless. So.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. Our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent, gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic here in Champaign. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union.
That's it for Focus 580 for the week. Time to hand things off to Celeste Quinn, hosting the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you, Jack. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the wind. It's a force of nature that makes life possible on the Earth, but it can also be, of course, a force of great destruction. At 1:06 this afternoon, we'll rebroadcast an interview with Mark DeVilliers, the author of Windswept. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices. Kansas September wheat trading at $4.85 and a half. That is unchanged. In Chicago, September wheat trading at $3.88, up one quarter. December $4.07 and a half, unchanged. September corn $2.37 and three quarters, unchanged. December $2.54 and a quarter, unchanged. March $2.68, down one quarter. December $3.02 and a quarter, up one quarter. August soybeans $5.76 and a half, up $2.50. September $5.84, up $3.25. November $5.97 and a half, up $2.50. November 2007 $6.52.